This episode of the Paranormal Podcast is brought to you by Cricut. Cricut makes perfect, classic, and easygoing polo shirts. For 20% off your first purchase, go to cricutshirts.com/paranormal and use the promo code paranormal. That's C-R-I-Q-U-E-T shirts.com/paranormal, promo code paranormal. Thanks, Cricut. And the Paranormal Podcast is brought to you by Club W. Club W is offering our audience members who are 21 and over and who live in the U.S. $25 off their first order and free shipping on 4 bottles of wine as a new member of Club W. So go to clubw.com/gym and get $25 off your first order when you become a new member of Club W. Thanks, Club W.
This is the Paranormal Podcast with Jim Harold.
Welcome to the Paranormal Podcast. I am Jim Harold and so glad to be with you once again. And boy, do we have a great show for you today. First up, we're going to have Rosemary Ellen Guiley and John Zaffis. Of course, you know Rosemary from her many, many books and appearances on this show and so many more. And John by his television show, Haunted Collector. And they've collaborated together on a new book called Demon Haunted, True Stories from the John Zaffis Vault. So that'll be a lot of fun. And then we have Janet Boyer joining us. She's going to talk about everyday divination. So we're going to learn that divination is about more than just maybe a Ouija board or tarot cards. You can use many, many different objects to do this. So that'll be fascinating. But first up, John and Rosemary, Demon Haunted. Our guests today are Rosemary Ellen Guiley and John Zaffis. Now, they are the co-authors of a new book called Demon Haunted, True Stories from the John Zaffis Vault. And both those names, if you've listened to this show for any time at all, should be familiar. John Zaffis and Rosemary Ellen Guiley research and investigate the dark side of the spirit world. And John has worked on high-profile cases of intense hauntings and demonic possession and starred in his own reality show, Haunted Collector, on Sci-Fi. He's also the nephew of the Warrens. And then we have Rosemary Ellen Guiley, and she's been on the show probably a dozen times at least. She's the author of more than 60 books. She's done groundbreaking work on shadow people, djinn, and persistent negative hauntings. She also hosts her own radio show, Strange Dimensions, on KGRA. John and Rosemary, welcome to the program today.
Oh, thanks for having us on.
Hello.
Well, I'm so glad to have you, Beth, gone to talk about this new book. Now, why Demon Haunted? Why did you think it was important to kind of examine the demon aspect of all of this?
Well, I think it's important to know and to understand and realize that, you know, with some of the objects and some of the different things that integrate, there are the negative, and there are those situations where you're going to have a negative perspective, especially when you're referring to occult items or religious items that could have been involved with something that was practiced and done on a negative level. So therefore, that will attach to some of these items and can wreak havoc.
Rosemary?
And also, Jim, we always take an educational approach when in our books and also in our lectures. And one of the reasons why we chose the term demon haunted, in addition to what John has elaborated, is that demon haunted means a wide variety of things that relate to spirit attachments and presences in objects, attachments to people, and also a presence on the land that often has a negative, unpleasant, or detrimental effect on people. And this is, in the broadest sense, a demonic influence. And it's demons don't always have to be exorcist-style possessions with, green slime down the walls and things like that. It can relate to a lot of unpleasant entity presences that are harmful to people. And so we're broadening out the category, too.
Well, that's the question. When people talk about a demon, they picture something. I think a lot of times it's red and it takes the form of almost like a devil, that kind of thing. From your perspective, both of you, your research, your investigation, actually facing some of these things, how would you define a demon?
Okay, we'll all jump on that one then. Again, when dealing with this, you know, it doesn't run around, it doesn't have hooves, and you don't see it with horns. I mean, people do experience that, yes. But looking at it from the realistic perspective, when dealing with the demonology end of this, I mean, it very seldomly, you know, will reveal itself. It'll be very subtle, and it will cause a lot of different things, disruptions within the family, will infiltrate the dreams, will wreak a lot of havoc, you know, with the individual. And it usually builds up. And again, the majority of the time when I deal with this and get involved with it, it's a fact that, you know, it's not this Hollywood version of what people perspect and, you know, visualize somebody going through a case that's dealing with something with demonic activity or, you know, again, dealing with an individual that, you know, truly might be possessed. Because possession is far and few in between. And a lot of times the characteristics of a person that's bipolar, schizophrenic, multiple personalities, they show the same characteristics that can, you know, appear in a case that might be, you know, of a person truly being possessed. So today, you know, we're very fortunate. We have those roads where, you know, most people will look at the big picture and say, you know, okay, let me go to a doctor, let me find out what's going on, let me see what's happening, because to me that's the most crucial part with this, and the comprehension and understanding of the fact of the difference between, you know, the possibility of a person being truly possessed or being oppressed in comparison to them having a situation of being bipolar, schizophrenic, or multiple personalities. So I take that approach, and to me, that's one of the most key initial things. But when dealing with the true fact of it and the true sense of a person being possessed, you know, we don't see figures usually standing around. We can see the individuals, you know, being taken over by something when a deliverance or an exorcism is being performed. And a lot of times, the characteristics can be gaining an enormous amount of strength, having knowledge of things they, you know, wouldn't even know anything about. And again, those are the characteristics that are most crucial and important that I look for when dealing with some of these issues and some of these topics. And covering it in, you know, Demon Haunted to me was extremely important. Collaborating with Rosemary is one of the, you know, most unique things that you possibly can do. And she has a good understanding and a knowledge base that's phenomenal with, you know, looking at the big picture of looking at things and asking the questions and knowing, you know, how to be able to pull a story together on an investigation.
Rosemary, you have anything to add to that about demons?
Just a little bit. I think John explained things very well. The class of demons, what we call demons, it's very broad. And in the ancient view, ranged anywhere from trickster to problematic to just out and out malevolent and evil. And here again, popular culture, mass media has focused on that terrorist end. So that it really skews our understanding of what the demonic realm is all about. And some of these entities are, they're not real malicious, but they do cause a lot of problems. And I think from a paranormal investigator standpoint, it is important to recognize this variety of influences and that these are all part of this concept of being demon haunted.
And I have to ask you, Rosemary, because we've done a show on this, you've done a book on it. What is the relationship, do you think, or maybe, between demons and the jinn?
Well, jinn act in demon-like ways, and I do believe that they are distinctly different. And John and I have shared some cases where, you know, we have identified a distinctly different energetic presence other than demonic, and it is jinn. These are supernatural entities who were on the planet before we were. They lost a lot of their dominion on the earth. There are various stories in religion and mythology describing that, and our interactions with them tend toward the hostile side and even the malevolent side. They're not all bad. Some of them are even enlightened. They're like human beings, the good, the bad, and the ugly. But the ones that seem to be most active in the human realm have hostile intentions. And I think that they fool a lot of investigators because in our culture, we don't know much about the jinn. And so when we identify entities that are acting out in malevolent ways, including possession, the automatic assumption is that it's demonic. And in many cases, it's actually jinn. And that does require some different approaches in many cases. We have to look at everything on an individual basis. It, a lot depends on the environment, the people involved, the reasons why the affliction is taking place. But it is important for people and investigators to realize that there are other players on the scene besides demons.
Well, it's a great discussion. We have two great guests with us. The book is Demon Haunted, True Stories from the John Zaffis Vault. Joining us are John Zaffis and Rosemary Ellen Guiley. And we'll be back right after this on the Paranormal Podcast. Before we get back to John and Rosemary, I want to give a shout out to our friends at Cricut Shirts. .com and thank them for supporting our podcast. Now, if you haven't heard of Cricut, well, we're going to fix that because you should hear about them. Cricut makes comfortable, sharp-looking polo shirts that perfectly mix old-school style and modern design. And I love this because it was founded by two guys in Austin, Texas, who wanted a classic, great-looking shirt. They couldn't find it, so they decided to found Cricut. I love that kind of entrepreneurial spirit. And they've hit a home run because Cricut shirts are made with super soft, 100% certified organic cotton, making their shirts as comfortable at the 19th hole as they are in the 18th. And I have a couple of them. I absolutely love them. They sent them along to me. The fit is not too baggy. It's not too skinny. And something else I like, you know, the shirts you buy in the store typically, they have what they call bacon collar, you know, where the kind of the collar rolls up and you wash it a time or two and it never looks right again. Well, with Cricut shirts, no more bacon collar, wrinkled, rippled, or limp. Nope, not with Cricut. Cricut shirts come with removable collar stays to help keep your collar looking crisp and new. And let's say that you get the shirt and you don't like it, which is not going to happen because you're going to love it. I love mine. They offer free, no-hassle returns and exchanges. It is the class of my closet. It's way better than any other polo shirt that I have, and I do like polo shirts. So, as a special offer to Paranormal Podcast listeners, get 20% off your first purchase by going to cricutshirts.com/paranormal and use the promo code paranormal. Do both things. That's CRIQUET shirts.com/paranormal, promo code paranormal. I'll tell you, they're timeless. They're great shirts. And that's the thing I love about this. You know, we do ads, we do advertising on the shows, but we really do vet the sponsors. And I do get samples of everything that we promote, and we've turned things down. But now with Cricut, I saw those shirts and I said, this is the real deal. I know you're going to love it. Thanks to Cricut Shirts, we're supporting the Paranormal Podcast. We're back on the Paranormal Podcast. Our guests today are John Zaffis and Rosemary Ellen Guiley. They are co-authors of the new book, Demon Haunted, True Stories from the John Zaffis Vault. And I love how you have this book broken down into different stories about different objects and in different situations. And with your permission, there's a few that I'm going to ask you about. And I have to ask about this one because it's first up in the book and it's also such a kind of striking title. What is Mirror Head?
Go ahead, Ro.
It probably was originally either an art object or an art and ritual object. It's like a mannequin head that has been covered in broken shards of mirrors. Hmm. And it's hollowed out. It has an opening in the back with crystals and more mirror shards in it, indicating to us that there was some energetic or perhaps ritual purpose for this this head. And it's quite riveting. It really captivates your attention. And it had a very strong spirit attachment to it that, since we don't know the exact history of how the head was built, possibly a spirit could have been invited in to occupy this head and wreaked a lot of havoc for a family.
With these types of items, like Rosemary was just stating, I mean, it's the most unique looking object. It's very striking. It stands right out to you immediately. And as I was looking at it and aware of some of the circumstances, you know, that tie in with paranormal activity, this piece of artwork, if you will, has all the ingredients right there to be able to hold on to different types of energies and different things. The mirrors, as we know, definitely do hold on to energy. There's a lot of different crystals, different stones that are in the interior of it. And again, I feel that with this object, it was devised, if you will, to hold on to things and to be used for different things. Could have been positive, could have been negative. Sometimes we really don't know, but when things are used like that, it holds on to those vibrations of things that it was used in. And when it comes into another person's possession, it can start to wreak havoc and can start to cause haunting in individuals' homes. So therefore, you know, when looking at that item and viewing it, you know, it just looks like the head of a mannequin. But it is the most unique thing, and you walk into a room, and it's very striking. It stands right out. So I keep it off into the side, and there's things around it, actually, because, again, I don't like energy necessarily reflecting around with other mirrors that are in the museum. We always try to deter that so that, you know, things aren't lined up and things aren't wreaking, you know, major havoc and causing problems within the museum once an item has been placed in there and the bindings and the rituals and different things have been done over them. Again, you know, when collecting and bringing these things together, you got to be extremely guarded, very careful, and watch what you're actually bringing into your home. Because today it's a big fad for people to collect items that are allegedly haunted or are haunted because people are curious. They want to see if anything's going to end up happening or things are going to occur. And that makes it difficult with a lot of people having the things directly within their home, especially a multiple of different things. You got to be very guarded, very careful when doing that. All my items are in a barn on the property. And again, you know, very safeguarded as can be when collecting these items.
Just wanted to add that what happens when people find these things, usually in a secondhand shop or a flea market, estate sale, something like that, is that they become riveted by the odd energy around these pieces. And it's almost like a siren song. They feel like they have to have it. And even if they feel that there's something creepy or unsettling about it, and so they bring it into their home environment, and then whatever is attached to it can often get loose. And people can have nightmares, they experience cold spots in the house, they see shadow figures, they might even hear strange voices in their head. And sometimes it takes them a while to figure out that all this is happening because of what they just introduced into the household environment.
I have to ask you this. It just occurred to me, and I don't know if either of you've had this experience, but there've been, when I was a kid, there were a couple of objects that I was really frightened of. And my parents had bought a small, modest home that they eventually retired to out of state. And we went there, and there was this ornate diploma on the wall with this real kind of calligraphy typewriting. And I was terrified of the object, so much so that they ended up getting rid of it. Now, maybe it was just something about the way it was written in the stylization. You know, it just could have been a weird thing. Or could I have been sensing something about that object? It just occurred. I've never thought about that until just now. Could I have been sensing something about that object? And it was probably at that time, and this was 1980, I was like 10 or 11 years old. This would have been probably dated from the 30s or the 40s, maybe even before that. What are your thoughts?
Well, in my opinion, a lot of times, especially with children, they're more susceptible to picking up on things if there is, you know, your energy around a item per se, regardless of what it is. And to me, one of the key elements with that is I'm in agreement, you know, with your family to remove the item, because that can trigger and cause something to happen once, you know, the recognition is given. So therefore, a lot of times when people tell me this, that, you know, there was different items around as they were growing up and they were uncomfortable with them, sometimes the parents would remove them, sometimes, you know, they would not. But again, it instilled within them, you know, with certain things that, you know, that guard goes up automatically with sensing, okay, I feel there's a possibility that, you know, there's just something icky or something creepy.
Yeah, it was weird. It was weird. It was a diploma. Now, it was with this real kind of old-fashioned stylized writing, and maybe something in my mind did not cotton to that. I don't know, but I was terrified of it.
Mm-hmm. Again, you know, it's something I deal with continuously with people, you know, with the items. When they purchase homes, a lot of times people, like you were just saying, items were left behind. Well, again, you know, a lot of times that makes you take that step back, being a paranormal investigator, and say, gee, why did they leave that behind? Was there an issue, or did they just not want that item? Because it's very common. A lot of times you go back and forth with individuals that there's a tremendous amount of items that were left behind, and, you know, is this something to be concerned with? And we have activity in the house. Do you think it could be tied in with something? So with me, sometimes it can be like looking for a needle in a haystack. And the most common thing I always recommend to an individual before, you know, jumping forward or making some type of decision, if there's multiple items there, you have to do the process of elimination. You know, take an item out. Let's see what happens. You know, if everything calms down, then it's a good possibility that's what the trigger item was, or just, you know, continuously remove those objects. It can be a lengthy process, and sometimes it can take some time discovering what that item is that the prior owner had left behind.
Yeah, I thought that was really interesting that you said maybe there was a reason they left it behind. Never occurred to me until just now after all these years. Well,
I had a strange case a few years ago with a very badly haunted house where the people moved in and the previous owners had left behind an art print. And it was a nice art print, not a real expensive one, but an artist of some note, and a signed and numbered print that was framed, and it was just sitting on the floor. So they kept it. They had several years of very bad activity, and they wound up selling the house, and when they left, they decided to leave this art print too. It was like, well, maybe that was part of the whole bad scene. And so I took it home, and I didn't have any bad activity in the house, but I hung it up, and then I decided to replace it with something else, so I took it down. And the piece of art that replaced it never would stay straight on the wall. Every time I walked into the room where it was hanging, it would be badly crooked. And so I thought, well, okay, maybe I should have this other piece back up. And so I went back to the haunted piece, and I put that back up, and everything was fine. So far it hasn't acted out in the house, but there was definitely an energy attached to it that I think the other people did sense.
Yeah, that's very interesting. Another thing I find interesting in this book, and again, these are some, if you're interested in this sort of thing, I highly recommend this book. This idea of of relics of painful deaths. Now, that sounds particularly macabre. Tell us about relics of painful deaths.
Well, again, too, a lot of times when dealing with an item, you know, a murder item or something that could have came from the war, the Civil War, you know, any of the wars, and this object could hold on to the energy of that deceased one. It can hold on to the energy of the individual, you know, that was in that circumstances. A good example is that we chose to talk about a relic that I have from, you know, the World Trade Centers in New York. It's something that, again, you stop and think about that. Many of the individuals that were associated, that had companies or, you know, were affiliates or something and had worked at the towers, were given little pieces, you know, of the metal as remembrance, not on a morbid level, but again, you know, something that they had physically to be able to hold on to. And when we look at that, you know, we try to look at it as a positive, not as a negative, but sometimes when these items come into different people's possession or they, you know, are in their environment, can something from a tragedy and something from that type of an atmosphere wreak havoc on a paranormal level? Absolutely. This one gentleman, he had a little piece of, you know, one of the buildings. His partner was a very prominent person in one of the companies that was there, and this was, you know, given to him. And he felt very uncomfortable. He felt that there was stuff around it, and it was something that he really just didn't want to keep in the house, and he wanted it removed. So again, you know, I was very honored to him giving it to me and placing it in the museum, you know, in honor, you know, of this individual, in honor of, you know, the tragedy. I mean, I have it in a glass case. It isn't always something I bring to the forefront or, you know, talk about all that much because, again, you know, for many of us, that was a very, you know, stressful day for any of us that lost friends or lost people we knew, you know, affiliated with it. But, you know, Rosemary and I were talking, and I felt that, you know, it was important to share the story and to share the information on how some of these items that came from, you know, such a devastating perspective, you know, can hold on to energy. And it doesn't always necessarily mean it's going to be something on a negative level, but enough can attach in such circumstances with a horrific act that it can cause a haunting.
Now, and go ahead.
A very bad haunting, too. Another piece we have is a license plate from a fireman who was killed in an auto accident, and his company members gave his wife his license plate as kind of a memorial piece. And she had it on display in her house, and it would like flip over and flip off the stand and had a bad energy around it. And it permeated the whole house. And we can speculate whether this might be earthbound souls themselves who are attached to the object, or residual energy like thought form energy that becomes very unhappy to the point where it's negative. But she wound up putting it away and getting rid of it then to John because it just it tainted the whole household and herself as well.
I think a lot of times when we look at the items from a tragedy or circumstances where, you know, people are holding on to them, the one thing I've noticed with certain individuals, I will ask them, why do you really, you know, want this out of your, you know, possession? Because most people just look at this as, you know, a remembrance or something of being able to hold on to things. But again, with the energy attached to it, it could bring in several other avenues due to recognition. I believe very strongly in that. And, you know, with several items that I do have, you know, here in the barn, you know, people wanted closure, and they wanted to be able to move on. And another case that just comes to mind, you know, again, you look at these circumstances. This woman kept this doll from her little daughter, and, you know, she was trying to have closure in her life, and she was being tormented by all these things. And she goes, John, it just reminds me too much of the whole circumstances and everything. And she goes, you know, I don't want to destroy it. I don't want to give it away. She says, would you please put it in your museum? She said, you know, I don't know if my daughter's attached to it or she isn't attached to it. She said, but it just feels that there's something there. I received the doll and I opened it up and there was dried blood on the doll. So my concern went up immediately, and I was on the telephone speaking to her, and she explained to me, she said, my daughter was holding that in the car accident when she was killed. And I believe that, you know, that's the remnants of, you know, her blood are still on the doll. And, you know, again, such a tragic thing, but she said to me at that point in time, she says, I have to have closure and I have to be able to move forward. And she said to me, this is one of the ways to be able to do it. Now, we've checked the doll a couple of different times, and there has been a little bit of energy recorded around it, but do I necessarily feel that that's something, you know, on a real, real evil level? No, but to be able to bring closure so a person can move on with their life, to me, that's very critical and very important.
I've got to ask you this, John, and Rosemary, you can chime in too if in your own experience you've had something similar. Has there ever been an object so frightening, so, for lack of a phrase, evil, or was had something attached to it that you just said, no mas, I want no part of it, I'm getting rid of it, I don't want anything to do with it? Has that ever
happened? Absolutely. Yes, absolutely. There have been items over the course of the years that I've removed from investigations that I chose not to bring back. Depending on the circumstances, usually those items are things that could have been involved with occult practices, something really horrific. And one of the telltale signs with me is, you know, the circumstances with the activity that's transpiring and happening. Sometimes to choose to bring closure, it can be very critical and very important, not only as far as dealing with an individual or a family, but also as an investigator. And I will choose to bury those items or to throw them into a body of water and to be able to contain and seal that energy so that it cannot wreak havoc, you know, any further. So there are items that I have made those decisions over the course of the years just not to bring back.
Rosemary, have you ever run into anything like that?
Years ago, yes. I was given a statue of the goddess Diana, and the statue had a curse on it. And I had it sitting in my office, and I started having like runs of bad luck and poltergeist phenomena, and I had a term for, I called it the retrograde demons, because it's, you know, how during when Mercury goes retrograde, you know, just all kind of wonky things happen. And it was that level of activity, and it just wouldn't stop. And finally, well, it came to my attention that the individual who had given me this statue bore me a lot of ill will, and that there might be a curse attached to it. So I did a cleansing on it, but I did not feel right keeping it. I just wanted it out. And so what I did was I put it in a bag and I threw it into very deep water. And after that, everything cleared up.
Interesting. Very interesting. Now, there are a number of stories here we could go and talk about. Many of them, you talk about demonic images, the demon box, the burned altar, corrupted religious objects, the Hudson Valley Havoc, a spirited liquor cabinet. I like that. Very clever. And a number of other ones. So definitely people should pick up on this. But before we let you go, I did want to talk a little bit about the Warrens. And John, you were related to the Warrens, correct?
Oh, absolutely. Again, you know, Ed Warren was my mom's twin brother. And again, you know, people always say to me, geez, what was it like working with Ed and Lorraine Warren? over the course of the years, I never really thought too much of it. It was just a cool thing. How many people have an aunt and uncle that chase ghosts?
Sure.
So, in looking back at it, the exposure, the different people I met, integrated with, and having, that opportunity of many years of working with my aunt and uncle was something very phenomenal. Because, again, Ed is no longer with us, and I naturally look at it and perceive it so differently. And now I just go, wow, what a golden opportunity that was, in that point in time in my life. Just, how many people, many years ago could say, you go to visit your aunt and uncle and you're going to just jump in the car with them and end up going to do an investigation, or
right,
they'll take you to go meet somebody, Buddhists, rabbis, priests, all these different individuals that I met over the course of the years. And again, intriguing and understanding it years ago, I looked at it so differently compared to now. And like I said, unfortunately, Ed is no longer with us, but very thankful for that time spending with them and having that opportunity to work with them. And, a bizarre coincidence transpired April of 2015, where, unfortunately, I ended up having a heart attack and going down. And it seemed to have altered something. And, again, we always hear about this and these different things, how, when a person has experiences that, deceased loved ones were around and everything. Again, I don't pay too much attention to things unless it's something I'm experiencing or something that is transpiring in my life. And then you take a look at that big picture and go, wow, these things do occur, and deceased loved ones do come around when things are occurring and happening with you, if you're in that danger zone. So again, it seemed, at that point in time, I really didn't give it too much thought, but all of a sudden, shortly after that, it started with me that when doing investigations or meeting people or talking to people, Ed Warren would start communicating with them. And it just got to the point where I just looked at the big picture, and when individuals start having communications with someone that's deceased, and they really don't know me, they really don't know that much, in regards to family or things of that nature, and they start coming out with this information, and you start recognizing voices and realizing, I'm hearing my uncle, I'm hearing my mother, I'm hearing my sister that passed away. And I think that the climax that just brought this whole thing, after almost 2 years to a point of comprehending it and is understanding it, was when, all of this occurred and all of this started happening, and recognizing his voice and hearing some of the different things that were coming through that, most people just wouldn't even know. And witnessing it and experiencing it, with 15 to 16 people around, is something phenomenal to look at. But it's a difficult thing. It's a very hard thing, because that's my family. That's what that's we look at that as a very guarded type of situation. You don't want to be tricked. You don't want to have something, feeding you false information. But looking at the big picture, and at the end of the day, making that decision was very heart-wrenching. Rosemary will tell you that. It was very hard for me to do that. But after 50 different people documenting this and experiencing these occurrences and these things are happening, I wanted it documented, and I wanted it where that information was there, that these things do occur and they do happen. And I had to look at the big picture from a different perspective. Now, when I went down, it wasn't, this major thing where I saw the pearly gates or a fluffy cloud or, any of these things were happening with a near-death experience. I don't really felt that I experienced anything to that level. And to be perfectly honest with you, at that point, when things were occurring and I started evaluating, several weeks afterwards, what transpired, it was very bizarre because I was like, uh-oh, if I did, literally did die that day or that night, and I didn't experience any of these things, where am I going? So, I look at this, I view this as something very personal, very special, and I was extremely grateful for several personal friends to contribute to this chapter, because to me that was more important. It was their experiences, what they witnessed, what they had transpire, because it's one of the farthest things in my mind to go into an investigation, go to a location, and want to, call upon family members. I never do that. I just don't, and I'm never going to do it because I don't think it's a circumstances that's going to prevail something to a point when dealing with, quote-unquote, a haunting. But I did take it a couple of steps farther because it was intriguing and interesting with the whole story. Mystic, Connecticut's an old seaport, and it's just someplace that I've always gone to since a child because I've always been very interested in the nautical. Mm-hmm. Again, naturally living on the coast, probably most people are. But it just started tying in where people were picking up on circumstances and things, tying in with Mystic, Connecticut, with him, and people getting information when I was up there visiting and going to different places. And it just got so complex in my mind and so complex with several different things tying in with that. But one thing that sticks into my mind, and, again, it's an afterthought, I thought about this, was the simple fact that when I was 16 years old, my uncle got the biggest kick out of it, that I was so interested in clipper ships and so many of these things from a nautical perspective, that he actually did a painting up of a clipper ship, and he had given it to me.
Yeah, many people don't realize Ed Warren was an artist.
Oh, gosh, yes. Yeah, I have several of his paintings. Phenomenal when Ed and Lorraine would paint, a phenomenal story, probably put in the next book. I have one painting. When I used to go up as a child, or a teenager, I should say, and take art classes with them, I was doing a farm scene, and Ed came over and he added a few things on the painting, and I'll put this in there, that'll look better. Then Lorraine came over and she started adding a few things on the painting and everything. And I don't know of too many paintings that I can sit back and look at and say, I painted it, and Ed and Lorraine Warren painted. All three of us have our basic, touching it and painting it. So to me, I thought it was an afterthought. And it's just, as I go along in Rosemary, it's sitting there going, here we go, another phenomenal story he's never talked about.
That's funny.
Sounds like the next book, John.
I know. But looking at that in perspective of it, it's a phenomenal thing. And like I said, over the course of the years, probably between Lorraine and Ed, I must have a good 10, 15 paintings, that they did that, they're very personal to me. Something that will always be displayed within my home, and I have a few of them out in the barn, something I would never consider selling or anything of that nature whatsoever. Watching him and watching her create their art form was just a whole totally different perspective on Ed and Lorraine, just watching them do it, taking a piece of wood and just start painting and watching, the end result.
Yeah, that's a fantastic, fantastic story. If somebody has an object in their home that they suspect is haunted, what can they do? What should they do? What should they look for, and what should their action be?
Well, my key thing is I always recommend to an individual, when they feel they've isolated the item that might cause the disturbance from the paranormal perspective, is put it out in your garage, or if you have a barn or a shed or something, remove it and let's see what happens. If all the activity calms down, the majority of the time I'll go, okay, it's that item. that is causing the disturbance and make a recommendation to them. I say make a decision on what you want to do. If it's a family heirloom or something, you know, I'm really not interested in it. You know, I have plenty of stuff, and a family heirloom is something special to individuals. So therefore, I'll say, you know, have someone do a blessing on it for you, put it in your safe deposit box, or give it to another family member. Or if they don't want to do that, I always tell them to pick an area or a room to put it in there where it won't cause any more disturbances, hopefully. But you will find the majority of the time a person will say, you know what, I just don't even want it in the house anymore. I don't even want to deal with this. And then, you know, they'll make a decision from there.
Objects also can be cleansed with energy and energy healing, prayers and blessings, exposure to sunlight, depending upon the object, sometimes sea salt is a purifying agent. And sometimes those activities will help remove an attachment. A lot of it's going to depend on what it is that's attached to an object. And sometimes it can be a very powerful presence that is going to resist going away. And other times it's not going to have such a strong hold on something and will be taken care of in that way.
Well, it's been a very insightful conversation today. The book is Demon Haunted, True Stories from the John Zaffis Vault. So the $64,000 question is, where can we find the book?
It's available on Amazon and John's website, my website. And as of today, it will be available in ebook format and Kindle, followed by Nook, Kobo, and iTunes.
Excellent, excellent. We're recording this on September 22nd, but so it will be there the second you log in whenever we do release this, which should be fairly shortly. Now, Rosemary, you mentioned the websites. Can you give both your and John's website so people can check those out as well?
Well, mine is visionaryliving.com, and John's is johnzaffis.com, but you have several, John, and what are some of the others that people could log on to?
Well, the johnzaffis.com one is the one that has my store and several of the books and other items that I've been involved with, DVDs, are available on there for purchase. And, you know, for the paranormal end of it, presning.com, that's my paranormal group that we still do investigations. We still get involved with things. And, again, you know, Facebook and several of those other leading key things that we all have to use these days to get things out there. I can tell you also where the book can be purchased.
Very good. Well, I really appreciate it. I think we've had a great discussion, and I think everybody who's listening to this should pick up on Demon Haunted, True Stories from the John Zaffis Vault. John Zaffis and Rosemary Ellen Guiley, thank you for joining us today.
Well, thank you for having me on.
Thanks, Jim.
Two great guests, and I hope that you enjoyed that show as much as I did. I was like catching up with John and Rosemary. And we have a third great guest coming up, Janet Boyer. But first, I want to tell you, if you are a fan of my Campfire book series, as I record this today, September 27th, 2016, run over to Amazon because my newest Campfire book is out, Campfire 5. And it is available for only 99 cents on the Kindle, 99 pence if you're in the UK. And check your country's Amazon store. There should be sale pricing on it. And basically, we're going to have it up for 99 cents for a very short amount of time. So if you're hearing this, better go check and see if you can still get it for 99 cents, because it won't be that way long. It'll go back up to regular price. And the great thing about Kindle books is you don't have to have a Kindle to read a Kindle book. Amazon has many free of charge apps for Android, for iOS, whatever kind of device you have, for Amazon devices, of course. So you don't really need a Kindle these days to read a Kindle book. And this book is, again, only 99 cents, 70 more spooky stories from our Campfire series. And you can read the series in any order. So you could start with book 5, and if you like it, go back to book 1. So you don't have to worry, oh, I didn't read the other books. So again, Jim Harold's Campfire 5, actually the official title is True Ghost Stories, Jim Harold's Campfire 5, 99 cents on the Kindle for a limited time only. Limited time. So if you don't get it for 99 cents now, you'll find yourself paying free price, full price, not free price. It's not going to be free, not for the foreseeable future. Maybe 5 or 10 years from now, but not right now. It's not going to be free. Put too much work into it. Also, we have a paperback. So if you're a traditionalist and you like that feel of paper, we actually have that for $12.99, which is actually cheaper than what our books usually are. So I guess you could kind of say that's almost on a sale too. So again, Campfire 5 available now. I'd love it if you could all go over and buy it, because if everybody in the sound of my voice buys this, we will have a mega hit. As of this morning, it's number one in the Kindle Supernatural category. We could drive it up. I'd love to have it in the top 100 of all Kindle books. But we can only do that with your help. So if you're someone who's listening, you can't afford the Plus Club, and I understand that, and you've not been able to kind of do anything to help the podcast monetarily, if you could just go buy that 99-cent book, I would really appreciate it, and do that as soon as you hear this, because it really does help and get up the charts fast, and then it helps you kind of stay in visibility and introduce new people to the shows. So thank you. Now we're going to talk to our friend Janet Boyer about everyday divination. Our guest today is Janet Boyer, and we're so glad to be with her once again. If you remember, Janet has been on the programs numerous times, specifically talking about the tarot. But today we're going to talk about something a little broader. We're going to talk about divination in general and the many ways that one can divine life and what's coming and fortune telling and so forth. And she has a book out on the subject that's called Reading the Mind of God, Divination, Prophecy, and Fortune Telling for Everyone. Now, Janet is a popular radio guest. She is an author. She creates these very intricate tarot decks. She has her own site at janetboyer.com. Very accomplished. And we love talking to her about these kind of things because she is a font of knowledge. Janet, welcome to the program today.
Hi, Jim. Thanks for having me again.
So let's talk about this a little bit. In terms of divination, I think of things like palm reading, tea leaves, Ouija boards, tarot. But it's far broader than that. It seems like you can tell the future with almost anything. Talk to us about this concept of using everyday objects and different types of things for divination.
Well, they've been around since humanity has been around. Humans have always wanted to know more about themselves, the world they live in. They've used divination to find out about hunting, you know, and crops and things like that. And it used to be just the realm of the religious leaders or the witch doctors or the shamans. But over time, just everyday humans were then accessing oracles, and it would be passed down, and the knowledge got disseminated. But humans have been using it for years, whether they are decoding cloud patterns or herds of animals, how they act. There is something called erinthomancy, where you can decode the flights of birds or even their bird song. They've used dice and bones. The I Ching has been around for years. It started out with the arrow sticks, but then there's the I Ching coins to access that knowledge. Tarot has been around, you know, as you mentioned, since the Middle Ages. Runes, which is to the Nordic belief system. So people have been using either man-made type of systems to divine, and those would be considered the mantic arts. And then there's the non-mantic arts, which is divination without tools. And it's the palm reading, like you said, numerology, where you decode past, present, and future, or even your name or locations, ideal locations for businesses through numbers. There's astrology, you know, when you're interpreting your signs, houses, and planets. There's dreams, oniromancy, where you decode symbols and dreams. Geomancy, you know, ley lines in the earth, or, you know, the way leaves look, where they fall. I mean, literally, there are so many ways to decode patterns. Now, divination, obviously, there's the word divine in it. So most, especially in the ancient times, they believed it was the gods that were sending them wisdom and information, and so they would consult oracles or most likely a shaman, a witch doctor, a spiritual leader, a minister, to decode what these can possibly mean. In the Old Testament, it was the priests. But even in the New Testament, you know, the Bible itself is filled with a lot of examples of everyday divination. Joseph in the Old Testament, looked into a wine goblet and saw a vision.
Mm-hmm.
He decoded a dream. Even after Judas hanged himself in the New Testament, you know, Judas was one of the 12 disciples of Jesus, and because he betrayed Jesus with the 30 pieces of silver to Jesus' crucifixion, you know, he felt remorse and he hanged himself. Well, after that passage, the disciples got together and said, okay, we need to replace Judas. So how do we do it? And they didn't pray. They didn't go, you know, necessarily didn't go, you know, wait for some angel to descend or go to a priest. What they did is they cast lots. And we don't know what those lots are. We don't know if they were sticks, if they were stones. You know, we don't really know, or bones even. It might have been links the stick. Okay, whoever gets the short stick gets to be the 12th disciple. But you think, you know, this is a big deal. You know, somebody replacing the 12th disciple and the rest of the 11 remaining disciples, they cast lots to replace them. So divination has been around for a very long time.
I mean, one of the things that we were talking before we started recording, entrails. I mean, that's kind of out there.
Yeah, some of the indigenous cultures, they would, you know, pray over an animal and then cut it open, and they would read how the intestines came out. Some would actually do the knuckles of certain animals. So, and use other different parts of animals to, whether live or dead, to discern, you know, the direction of the tribe or major decisions. So, if you can think it, there is probably a divination system out there. I mean, people have used candles to divine whether they're looking at the shapes of the flames or how the candles, like, well, blowing out candles for the birthday, you know, happy birthday to you, you know, blow out the candles. Well, that was stemmed back to divination, whereas if, you know, you blow out all the candles, that meant good luck. There's even a type of system where you put 12 candles around in a circle. Now, preferably in a place where there's no carpeting or flammable objects, but 12 candles, and as you go around each and put each candle down, you say, okay, this is January, this is February, this is March. You go around in a circle, and kind of like Jack be nimble, Jack be quick jumps over the candlestick. So the person then jumps over each candle in the circle, and then supposedly, you know, if the candle blows out, it's bad luck for the future. If it stays lit, it's good luck. Now, that's a very simplistic type of divination. That's more like fortune-telling. But I'm more into systems that are more intricate, obviously, you know, my tarot work, because I think tarot is such a cool universal way to access symbols that are universal but also personal. But then there's charm-based systems, like I've just made a charm oracle with 60 different charms. I made an original set, and then there's an animal set, animal totems. And that is actually based, the animal totem set is actually based on, I did a ton of research on animal behavior, what shamans and indigenous cultures have associated animals with. And a lot of it is common sense, or maybe not so much common sense, or it's common knowledge. For example, the owl. You know, what do you think of when you think of an owl?
I think of the eyes.
And you think of wisdom. Yeah, exactly, the eyes and wisdom. I mean, even owl from Winnie the Pooh, he's the wise teacher. The owl was one of the main symbols of Athena in Greek mythology. And so owls then represent wisdom, observation. You know, it's good that you point out about the eyes, because there's the observation element, the watchfulness, you know, seeing from different angles, eyes in the back of the head. And that's just the owl. And so, you know, I made an extensive system that's just for animals, and then I have a general system that has, you know, things that are as updated as a computer. And I ascribe the meaning to a computer as public knowledge, data, the internet, research, networking. And so, you know, you can take any existing system, or you can create your own system. Even flipping a coin, if you think about it, is a form of basic divination. You know, yes or no, which restaurant should we go to? Heads or tails? That's what my husband sometimes does. He goes, it's time to bring out the coin. When we can't figure out, you know, which restaurant to go to, you flip a coin. In a way, that's a form of divination, because you're ascribing, okay, heads to this restaurant, tails to that restaurant. But whether or not you choose to go, therein is, in my opinion, the nexus between common sense and divination. You know, I'm not the type that I believe that you should always be looking for signs and omens, that you should govern your life by them. I think they should inform your life and make life interesting and exciting, but I don't think, you know, that you need to be constantly looking for signs to where you're not really living. I mean, even Freud said, in terms of dream interpretation, he said, sometimes a cigar is just a cigar.
That's right. You know? Right. Yeah, I agree with that. You have to keep your feet on the ground to some extent. Now,
absolutely.
In this book, you talk about the mantic and the non-mantic arts. What is the difference between the mantic and the non-mantic arts?
Well, mantic arts are any divination with tools, things that you know, are tangible, that you can hold in your hand or you see with your eyes physically. That would be like runes, like we talked about, where there's 13 runes. You know, you put them in a bag, you pick out a rune or a set of runes. Cartomancy, which is divination with cards, and that could be playing cards. Some people read playing cards. It could be an oracle decks or tarot. The I Ching is a form of a mantic art because, again, you're using either the yarrow sticks to divine the hexagrams and trigrams of the I Ching, or you use the I Ching coins, where there's three coins that you toss. Dowsing is another divination with tool because, you know, you use the stick for water witching, which utility companies have been using this for hundreds of years to find buried cables and pipes or to find water. That's what water witching, the term, comes from. But dowsing is also pendulums, you know, where you take a pendulum and you might have a special chart where you have assigned different meanings to the pies in a chart, or some people use it for healing to diagnose illness, where they lay someone on the table, kind of like massage table and energy healers. They would run a pendulum over the body to see if it reacts towards different chakras or parts of the body. Scrying, like we were talking about with Joseph in the Old Testament, you know, seeing a vision in a goblet of wine or any shining surface, that's where, you know, crystal ball gazing or looking into mirrors. See, because you're using your hands, or even tea leaf reading, like you mentioned earlier, you know, where you drink the tea and then you try to discern the patterns of the tea leaf in a cup. So anything that is actually physical that you can hold in your hand or see with your eyes, that's a mantic art. Non-mantic arts are more things that are intangible, things like, you know, we're talking about looking at patterns of animals, how the herds may go, how a bird may fly, the kind of songs that they sing if a particular bird pops up, you know, in front of you. Astrology, you know, yes, you know, you're using a natal chart, which is based on your birthday, but again, you know, it's all theoretical. It's not in your hands. You know, we're discerning the planets of your birth and the houses they are in and the signs. Numerology, again, yes, we have numbers, but numbers are intangible things. They're not things we're holding in our hands. We've just said, okay, you know, we've come to this universal conclusion that ones, you know, represent singularity and other things. Two represents, companionship or debate. There's an I and an other. Three is a lot of times creation. But, you know, those are set systems, but then, of course, you can ascribe your own meanings depending on your own personal experience. So, basically, mantic arts is anything that is tangible that, you know, you can hold or see. Non-mantic are things that are more intangible and wispy or in the mind or theoretical.
Are there certain things that just resonate and work better with different people? For example, you might take someone who picks up a tarot deck and it doesn't really do anything for them, but they use a Ouija board or they use a scrying or they use a pendant of some type, and that resonates with them and works far better. Is that the case?
I think so. I think more visual type people may be more drawn. Like me, I'm highly visual, so that's one of the reasons I like tarot and I like the charm sets I've made, because to me, I've made visual representations of something that means something else. So one small symbol, like pulling a dragonfly or a rabbit, actually means a whole lot more than that. And I'm very visual, and so I think clairvoyance is probably my highest and most honed intuitive skill. But I think somebody who perhaps is more clairsentient, where they can discern things through the body or through the gut, those are the type of people that may be more into reading auras or doing pendulums or doing muscle testing, you know, those type of things that are more with the body. So absolutely, I do think that, and I also think, too, that it's best to focus on maybe one, two, or three main ways of divination, so you don't get overwhelmed. But yeah, I do think that sometimes, you know, some things work for some people and not for others. And also, too, sometimes I think certain divination systems are more applicable to certain life situations. Mm-hmm. For example, some people use tarot for yes or no questions. I think that's ridiculous, personally, mm-hmm. because the tarot is so rich in symbolism and so perfect for everyday occurrences and complexity of relationships and business that it seems almost a waste to use a tarot card for yes or no when you can flip a coin. You know what I'm saying? Whereas other systems, I think if somebody is more introspective and introverted, perhaps they might enjoy dream interpretation, where they write down their dreams and, you know, they look for reoccurring symbols. Perhaps they look it up in symbol books or find out, you know, how that symbol's been seen in history. But then they add their own meaning because they know that every time this particular symbol crops up in their life, it usually indicates this is going to happen. So, yeah, absolutely. Like, for example, with dream interpretation, I just don't really have a knack for that. My husband, though, he doesn't keep a dream journal or anything, but if I have a complicated dream, I'll sit there and tell him. And I never know what he's going to say. Sometimes he goes, "What did you eat before you go to bed?" but then other times he comes up with this really awesome, plain, and perfect explanation. I'm like, "Oh, my God, why didn't I see that?" You know? And I think some people just have certain gifts with certain divination, so it's good to experiment and see what you're drawn to first. And if that doesn't work, you know, you could go to something else. But sometimes you do have to stick with it. Something like tarot that is very extensive and complicated, one of arguably the most complicated divination tool. There are so many books and blogs out there now that a person can, you know, learn how to use tarot quite easily, like my first book, Back in Time Tarot, where I teach people to start with their favorite movies or their memories or songs and then work backwards to learn the tarot. So then you're starting with pop culture, and then you're learning one of the most complex systems of divination, rather than taking these 78, actually more than that, meanings and cards, and then you're trying to apply some of this ancient and outdated prescriptions to your own personal life. So absolutely, I think people have certain intuitive gifts and bents that make certain systems more, you know, easier for them, like water. You know, there's some people that can do that water witching thing where they take the stick that's branched out into two, and they can go out in the field and, by golly, find water.
Yeah, it's
absolutely.
It's absolutely fascinating. It is an interesting discussion we're having. Our guest today is Janet Boyer. We'll be back and we'll talk more about divination right after this on the Paranormal Podcast. The Paranormal Podcast is brought to you by Club W. Club W is offering our audience members who are 21 and over and who live in the U.S. $25 off their first order and free shipping on 4 bottles of wine as a new member of Club W. And we are so excited because Club W is a great company, and they have a great concept. You know, the fact is many people never go down the wine aisle because they feel intimidated. But Club W is making wine shopping something that's very approachable, very accessible, because they're targeting a new generation of wine drinkers like me who want to do away with all that pretense and simply enjoy reasonably priced, great wine. It's just a great deal. And I got to tell you, you know, I've said this before in the show when we talk about Club W, I was turned off of wine very early on, very early in my career. I worked at a high-end radio station. I go to these parties. Everybody was very snobbish about their wine. They kind of like swirl it around their glass and say, "Oh, it has nice legs." I didn't know what they were talking about. And I thought, that's not for me. I'm a working class kind of guy. Well, the truth is wine is really for everybody. And we could do away with all that stuff now. All you have to do is you go over to clubw.com/Jim and you take their 20-second palate profile quiz, the palate profile quiz, I should say, to get instant wine recommendations based on your unique profile. Now, the way that they work at the price point for most wines is $20, and they have a deal now for listeners of the Paranormal Podcast where you sign up with Club W, you'll essentially get your first bottle for free. Basically, here's how it goes. Club W is offering our audience members who are 21 and over and who live in the U.S. a $25 credit on their first order and free shipping on 4 bottles of wine as a new member of Club W. And, you know, it's kind of fun now because I look forward to my shipments and I kind of read up on the wines and I'm learning, and plus I'm enjoying the wine. Right now, I'm enjoying a 2014 Alchemist Noir Red Blend. And believe me, without Club W, I would have no idea what that means. So, to receive a $25 credit on your first order, do what I did. Go over to clubw.com/Jim. That's clubw.com/Jim. Sign up as a new member. I think you'll love it. And thanks, Club W. And please drink responsibly. We're back on the Paranormal Podcast. Our guest is Janet Boyer. She is an expert in the tarot and very knowledgeable in all areas of divination. And we're talking about that and her book, Reading the Mind of God, Divination, Prophecy, and Fortune Telling for Everyone. So since we mentioned fortune telling there, you make a distinction between fortune telling and forth telling. What is the difference between fortune telling, which I've obviously heard of, and forth telling, which I'm not sure I have?
Well, forth telling is more having insight into what a person is going through right now, as well as their past. And I believe that it's pretty easy in most cases to tell where a person's going to go in their life based on where they're at now or where their past is. And so forth telling is more, you know, seeing where the person's at now, what they're dealing with, and perhaps past patterns and belief systems that led them where they are, because those have a great impact on where they're going into the future. And that's kind of like how in the New Testament, when Jesus went up to the woman in the well, and she says, you know, I perceive that you have been married before and things like that. And he was basically forth-telling. He was telling what he knew about her, what he sensed, in order to bring the good news to her. Fortune-telling is when you're trying to discern the future. But I even make a distinction between divination and fortune telling. I believe divination is when you're trying to seek knowledge to grow as a person, to infer what is happening to you and what is happening in your relationships and your career, and also to discern what is your highest good and to discern even what your values are. We have so much information bombarding us, whether it's through the media, the opinions of others, family members, and sometimes it really can drown out our inner intuitive voice of what we value in life. So many times we don't even question our values. You know, we think we value one thing, but if we really sat down and wrote it down and said, okay, whose values are these? Are these really mine? Are they my mother's? Or are they my father's? Or am I trying to live up to something of my grandfather's? You know, and so once you know, divination can help you get quiet. So this can be a form of meditation to where you discern, okay, wait a minute, what are my values? And who am I living for here? And what really brings me joy? And why am I always getting stuck in this particular life pattern? And how can I get out of it? So I consider that divination. Fortune telling, I admit to frowning upon and kind of giving it the stink eye because I think we as humans obviously want to try to control our lives and control what happens. And there's also that sense of ego and greed as well. And I think fortune-telling is more when you are trying to, for example, pick numbers for the lottery. You know, I consider that fortune-telling. Or when you're trying to do some psychic voyeurism, which I feel is unethical, where you're trying to read the mind of someone else and say, okay, what does he really think of me? I consider that fortune-telling type of stuff. And I'm not down with that. That's just me personally. I just think it's unethical. I think it's quick fixes. Like, you know, you think, okay, well, if you win $1 million in the lottery, all of a sudden your life will be perfect and you will have joy. And all you have to do is look at studies of people who've won the lottery to find that is absolutely not true. In fact, it usually makes their life worse. So fortune-telling, I think, is sometimes the human ego trying to have quick fixes to get out of their situation, where I'm into divination, where you really go deep within yourself and you say, okay, what kind of patterns am I participating in that I'm creating these webs around me, where I'm, you know, binding myself, where I'm sabotaging relationships, where I am negatively affecting my career because of my choices, my beliefs, and my worldview. And divination can help us really kind of strip down to the bone and say, okay, wow, this is actually what I believe. And so tarot can use that, any of these cards, you know, type of system with cartomancy, other oracles, it can actually give us an aha moment for us to see out of ourselves, to kind of get a bird's eye view and see our lives symbolically and give us information clear and detailed that sits apart from all that barrage of information we get from everyone else that may not be in our best interest.
How do you think all this stuff works. I know there are various theories out there. I mean, what is the mechanism of divination, of getting this information? Where does it come from and how do we get it?
That is a very good question, and nobody knows.
And I figured that was the answer, but what are some theories?
Well, you know, the thing is, Jim, everything is narrative. Everything in our life is a story we tell ourselves. So that's why there's so many factions even within one religion. I mean, you take, let's say, Christianity. Look how many denominations are within that religion. And then look at even within one denomination how there's disagreements over biblical texts and doctrine and way to behave. And same way with views on, you know, political parties or somebody witnesses a scenario and, you know, you have 15 different interpretations of what everyone just saw. If you think about it, everything is a story we tell ourselves, and belief is powerful. And so I say, why not make our own personal empowering narratives that we can use for these everyday oracles? But some of the theories of where does divination work, obviously the most simple, as you know, I mentioned earlier, is that it comes from God. God, him or herself, is actually somehow kind of like channeling, you know, through the sibyls, how they did in the Greek oracles, you know, they would go and consult the oracles. It's from some god or goddess or an overreaching divine source or angels that is giving information to humanity. The Swiss psychiatrist and psychologist Jung said it was, you know, could be synchronicity. And he was, you know, a student of symbol of myth, and he was a believer in tarot, and he didn't think anything was random and everything happens for a reason, and that when two unrelated things seemed to happen at the same time, that that meant something. And it was up to us to try to divine or figure out what that is. But Jung also believed in the collective unconscious. You know, so when we're divining, are we tapping into some universal unconscious source that can give us information if we just tap into it? Others say it's our higher self that our, you know, subconscious exerts some energetic force that somehow affects the divination tools, you know, affects what cards we feel drawn to or what runes to pick or how we interpret a dream symbol. Then there's plain old intuition. There's the psychic gifts, whether it's, you know, clairvoyance, where somebody picks up more visual objects, clairaudience, where a person can actually hear a voice. I know when my husband and I first got married and we were trying to decide whether or not to have a child, I actually heard, and this was the first time I think I've ever had actual clairaudience, where I heard a little boy's voice said, "Mommy, Daddy, please let me be born." And I was like, "Holy cow, did you hear that?" And he's like, "What?" You know, and wouldn't you know, 3 months later, I did get pregnant. It was a little boy, and his voice ended up sounding like my son. And I believe that his soul on the other side was saying, "Hey, come on, it's time. Get with the program." you know, and
right.
There's the theory of the Akashic record, supposedly, where, you know, there's Akasha is this this metaphysical library of everything has ever happened, is happening, and will happen. And that we can somehow tap into that, almost like this cosmic library, and get the information we need. So there's a lot of theories, and you can even be an atheist, not believe in God, and still, you know, use divination and as a way to make sense out of your life and to make order, because there are patterns. You know, there are patterns, there is knowledge you can access, and you don't technically even need to believe in a higher power or God to use it.
How do we know that, or can we know, if this is real, the feedback that we're getting is real in the sense of, you know, somebody may be reading into a particular result, what they want to hear or what they think. You gave the example of talking with your husband in terms of dream interpretation. And
right.
I mean, that may be very valid. Maybe somebody else does that, though, and they just kind of interpret the dream to mean whatever they want it to mean. How do you discern from real signals of the universe to just maybe your own mind cooking something up? How do you do that?
Well, it's interesting you say what is real, because it reminds me of The Matrix. You know, all these people thought there was things that were, quote, real, but they were really hooked up to The Matrix.
Right.
And then they got unplugged, and they're like, holy cow, you know, it's Neo, The Matrix has you. And reality is just basically experience. So I look at it this way. Why not have the best experience we could possibly have? So I think with that, when we're consulting divination or even just living life, always reach for the best thought, the most positive thought, the best thought, the most empowering thought, or the most constructive thought. You know, and so with dream interpretation, I never use that to guide my life. I don't even use tarot to guide my life, to be honest. I have defied the tarot more than once. But even in that, I think, is a beneficial type of action. Because why am I defying what I see? It's because I don't really want that to happen, or I don't really want that for my life. So then I take my free will and I say, you know what? This is what I'm going to do. Thanks for your input. And so I think that common sense plays a part. Obviously, I think if a person has mental issues or diagnosis or depression or a history of hallucinations or schizophrenia in the family, things like that, obviously I don't think divination is particularly good for them, only because they may not be able to discern, what is helpful and what is not. But for the average Joe, how do we know what is real? Again, that's why I've created oracles like Tarot and my charming oracle set, because I say, let's put it in our own hands. Let's create the kind of life we want. And, if we're going a certain direction, then we adjust. It's just like driving a plane. When you pilot a plane, they're not always, moving around the wheels and things. They do what is course correction. So, they'll travel a few thousand, miles, they'll adjust their the height and things, and they course correct. So I think that's what we, need to do as humans. I mean, Einstein said a definition of insanity is to keep doing things over and over the same way, but expecting a different result. So I think that oracles, especially the mantic type of oracles, the ones that you can use in your hands, whether it's the I Ching or tarot oracle decks, things like that, I think those are especially helpful because then it's right in front of our eyes, and then we can analyze, okay, is this helpful or not? And I also encourage people to keep a journal. I keep a journal with their associations, like, okay, a dragonfly appeared to me 3 times. What could that mean? So they can always look at an animal oracle deck, or they can look at books about animal shamanism or animal divination, or they can come up with their own meanings. Like, maybe they have a memory from childhood that, the grandmother had this, dragonfly necklace. And so then after she passed, a dragonfly would, show up, and so that they would assume, okay, this is a message from grandma or what have you. So, we don't know quite what anything is real. It's always a story. So I say, make a story that is empowering, that is safe, that is common sense, and that's constructive. And keep a journal, write down what you think is going on and see how that happens. And if you're in a really difficult situation, though, I would always consult a psychologist or a mental health therapist or a doctor, rather than making very major decisions or anything affecting, your health, obviously. But in terms of, wondering what your life purpose is, what the nature of a relationship is, what you can do to enhance communication, let's say, between a mother and a son, or how you can do better at work, or, things like that, I think divination tools can be very, very helpful to empower us to make more informed decisions. And it's fun because it helps us expand our imagination. If you look at all of the great inventions, so many of them were a result of dreams. People have had intricate, solutions to even physics problems. I think Einstein as well, in dreams or in just that relaxed state where you're, Ben Franklin, when you're between waking and dreaming. I think we've gotten so logical as humans that we've kind of squeezed out the imagination. And I think that's why a lot of indigenous cultures had dancing and drumming and storytelling around the fire, because it stimulated our imagination. And I think imagination is very much connected to intuition and connected to those nether realms where we get the divine information or, the pattern, universal patterns, to where we can draw on to enhance our life and make it more creative and fun.
Now you talked about some of the ones that you like, but is there one that people really kind of maybe poo-poo or aren't as aware of that's like kind of like a dark horse that you think is very powerful that people just kind of go, eh? But is there one that you would kind of call a diamond in the rough, so to speak, in the different kinds of divination?
I think anybody who goes, eh, with a divination are usually skeptics who kind of throw all of divination out. Because I think usually people who are within divination are open-minded enough to realize that, even though a system may not work for them, it could work for someone else. Pendulums, for example, I've tried to use them, and I don't trust them. And the reason why I personally, myself, do not trust them is because I have enough knowledge to be dangerous. I know that our psychological makeup is connected to our subconscious and our beliefs. So the reason I personally don't trust pendulums is because I believe, well, at least for me, is maybe I can't be objective enough, but I believe that pendulums can be affected by our assumptions and our gut reactions, and therefore it will, you know, not necessarily divine, you know, what is wrong with a situation or a person, or but instead pick up what we really want to hear. Ouija boards, I would totally stay away from. I mean, that's just me, because I think Ouija boards encourage us to release too much of our self-will and our common sense, and I think it can open up to entities. I'm not sure I believe in demons, but I do believe in ghosts, and I believe in stuck spirits that, you know, maybe have died violent deaths or suicide, or, you know, suddenly, and they need to go to the light. But even if there are other spirits, whatever, I'm not going to risk it. You know, I just think Ouija is, you know, that's a dark horse, all right, but not a diamond in a rough. I just think that, you know, stuff like that, I do not advocate personally, and I think that you're just opening yourself up to, you know, Jung and a lot of the psychologists and psychiatrists who did groundbreaking work on the subconscious and dreams and what have you, they basically said the subconscious is like the garbage dump of our mind. And perhaps even, you know, there's a garbage dump version in the Akashic Record or the collective unconscious. And I think when you do things like Ouija boards, I think you're accessing the garbage dump. I think you're accessing your fears, traumas, wounds, things that you've tried to suppress and bury, possibly making openings for other people's crap and their energies. You know, I think, I just, you know, personally, I'm not into it. As far as the diamond rough, I think the coin, flipping a coin can be really helpful. Like my husband and I, we do not bring out the coin. It's always a quarter, not a special quarter. but some people actually have made metal coins that have yes and no on one side. I think that sometimes that's underappreciated. I think if it's a non, you know, not a big decision, obviously, should we buy a car or not? Let's flip a coin. I don't advocate it for that. But, I mean, you know, simple things where, you know, you're hanging out and you can't figure out the restaurant, why waste time, you know? And I think sometimes the coin, so we only bring out the coin every once in a while, and then we have this agreement, you know, are you sure? Because we're going to do what the coin says. And, you know, so it's kind of like a funny, solemn type thing. And once in a great while, though, the coin will go, and we'll both go, oh, man. And it just shows us what we really felt, but we couldn't access because our brain was overloaded. And so then we kind of discard the coin and say, okay, well, now we know what we really want. So, but another times when we can't make, our minds up, we're like, okay, let's do the coin. You know, we're debating between five restaurants, and it's my husband, I, and our son. Let's flip the coin. And that way, you know, it kind of saves time. You know, it takes us from ruminating and debating, getting into fights, you know, sitting in the car for 45 minutes, sweating our butts off, trying to figure out, okay, hurry up, the X is coming, where are we going to go? So I think the coin, I think that is the little diamond in the rough that we sometimes overlook and can be great for the little decisions in life.
Well, it's been a fascinating discussion about the topic of divination. I think we've all learned something. But if people want to learn more, whether it's the book or your website and all the other work that you do, where can they go?
The main hub is always janetboyer.com. And from there, then you can access our decks, the Snowland deck. My husband and I are working on a coffee-themed tarot right now. That's really fun and exciting. And then, of course, we have the Charm Oracles where we have set up. My son and I, my teen son actually helped us. We thought, okay, what symbols are universal enough that anybody can use? And so then we wrote them down and gathered about 60 charms in the regular charming oracle, and then 60 animals for the animal totems. And then we did extensive research, and we came up with keywords for all of them. And so that way, somebody doesn't have to come up with their own. They can get them from us on the website, and we'll send them a pretty bag of charms with a PDF keyword. And we even have a secret Facebook group for all of our oracles, so you can practice, you can ask us anything. But, you know, they can always also create their own, obviously, too. And I teach people and have articles on my website and my blog about that as well. So everything I'm doing, I'm working on my third tarot book right now called Naked Tarot. That there's no naked pictures in it, but it's stripped down tarot for, you know, every day, you know, in plain speech. So I'm working on that. So we're always busy creating oracles. I'm really big on divination because I want to empower people. It's fun, it's encouraging, and I want people to start taking their life and the direction of their life in their own hands instead of relying on religious leaders or gurus that often disappoint. you know, and to have a more richly rewarding, interesting, you know, life and imagination and honing their intuition and learning to trust their own vibe. So they go to JanetBoyer.com. They can find out all my books, my ebooks, our oracles, decks, everything.
Janet, thank you for joining us today on the Paranormal Podcast.
Thank you so much for having me. It was fun as always.
I hope that you enjoyed that episode as much as I did, you know, with these multiple interviews. The show is getting longer and longer every week, but I trust that is a good thing because our numbers are getting bigger and bigger and we're getting more and more downloads. So please do tell a friend about the Paranormal Podcast and the Campfire today. And also, remember, you can get my Campfire 5 book on Kindle for only 99 cents. And also, please support our friends at Cricut and our friends at Club W. We thank you so much for tuning in. We will talk to you next time, and have a great week, everybody. Bye-bye. Now for the legal disclaimer. We do not accept money from publishers or content producers in exchange for interviews. However, as with most media outlets, in the majority of cases, we do receive complimentary copies of books and DVDs that we feature on our podcasts. Your purchases of books, DVDs, and other items via our Amazon.com links benefit Jim Harold and JimHarold.com and help us continue our programming. The sponsor messages you hear on the programs are paid endorsements, although we really do like them. For the full disclaimer, go to JimHarold.com, and thanks for listening.